Hi everyone, welcome back. It is wonderful to see all of you. New faces, familiar faces, etc. Tonight we begin our new course, Halakha Bishana, Jewish Law in a Year. And I'm really excited about it. I've had a lot of fun preparing, researching, organizing, buying books, reading books, planning to read more books throughout the year. I'm really excited for a really great course. And I want to talk a little bit more about it. I just wanted to just start by saying we have program guides in the back. If any of you haven't gotten a program guide in the mail in the past, take one home. You can see about a lot of things that are going on. One event which isn't in the program guide is Friday night dinner we're having next Friday night. We're going to be having a guest speaker who's going to be talking about Abraham Lincoln and the Jews. It's the 150th anniversary of the Civil War, so we wanted to commemorate that. We obviously, we were here. I mean Sherith Israel was here, and Abraham Lincoln wore a top hat, which sort of makes him a member of the synagogue. So we thought it was a good time. So everyone, there's a flyer in the back. If you're interested, you can sign up for that. What? Yeah, there's a brown flyer on the table back there. I brought it in late, so you may have missed it. Okay, great to have all of you here. I want to say some words of introduction, but let me start by just... let me start by introduction. What we're doing starting tonight is a continuation of a set of learning that we've done for several years already with our various Shana courses. I see some friendly faces from the beginning of this whole enterprise. And this is now the fifth in this series of six year courses covering all the major areas of Jewish learning, of Jewish knowledge that should create the bedrock, the framework for one's understanding of Judaism, Jewish life, and so on. And so it started by studying Tanakh, the Jewish Bible, going on to study the major works over the past two millennia, then looking at major events in Jewish history and their lasting impact. Then last year, looking at Jewish philosophy, and this year, Jewish law. And please God, next year, tefillah, Jewish prayer. And the idea behind these various courses is to present a comprehensive understanding of these bodies of Jewish knowledge, so that I find oftentimes, certainly into adulthood, our education becomes very piecemeal. We learn a class on this topic, a lecture on that topic, you see an article on something else, and it's all over the place. And generally speaking, when people go to classes, it's on very specific types of learning. And the thought was is that people would be interested in saying, hey, let's go back to school, but back to school as adults, and learning on an adult level, to go back and to say, now let's go with, from an adult perspective, engage in Jewish learning in this broad, systematic type of way. So that at the end of each year, end of this year, to have a strong sense about how halakha, how Jewish law functions, to really break it down into its various elements, so that at the end of the year, person can have a sense of, I get how it works, I understand the major elements, I see exactly how it functions, and then, while it's only a year course, it's not going to be comprehensive in every detail, but then, when studying elsewhere, studying, hearing another lecture or class, to then have the framework through which to fit different pieces into. And the idea is that through these six courses, we'll create the framework so that anything else that you learn afterwards, you'll know where to put it, and be able to build off of it, and hopefully having a more broad and sophisticated understanding of Judaism. So the way that we're going to look at this course of Halakha is that each week we're going to study what I would call either one aspect or one topic every single week, and each class in that sense will stand on its own, but collectively will operate as a unit. So along those lines, if a person misses a particular week, shouldn't feel like, oh, you know, I can't, now I'm missing out. No, you miss a week, still make sure to continue to come. Each class will stand on its own, but at the same time, I would encourage you to come as often as possible so that you can get that structure that we're building together through coming to all of the classes. And specifically, that's the idea behind the registration. We'll ask everyone who comes to register. Classes are open and welcome for anybody who wants to come at no cost. But for those of you that are interested in being able to make up classes that you missed, I'm recording each week. I'll be even making copies. I have a binder, which I'll give out to whoever registers, that you'll be able to catch up on anything that you've missed. So if you missed a particular week, so the next week you come in, you pick up the CD, you pick up the handouts, and you'll be able to make sure that you can stay with the whole area of learning. So I encourage as many of you that are interested to do so. Many of you already have, but that way you can get the full effect of the course. But I want everyone to still feel welcome. Even if you don't want to pay, come as often as you like. I'd be very happy to have you here. What we're going to be talking about in this course is going to be framework, not philosophy. That was last year. We're not going to be speaking so much about philosophy behind halakha, why does God command us? We'll talk about that a little bit tonight as a way of introduction, but throughout the year, we're going to be much more interested on the nuts and bolts. How exactly does it work? How does it function? I think we often have a sense that halakha is just kind of this haphazard set. Let me turn on some air. This haphazard smorgasbord, if you will, of ideas, of laws, arbitrary people just making decisions, how exactly do things work. So the point of this course is to help break down the elements that will hopefully allow all of us, including myself, to better understand the halakhic process, how decisions are made, what halakha is, what changes, how change operates within the structure of halakha, when change is possible, when change isn't, why is it sometimes possible, why is it sometimes not. And a lot of that is going to come down to understanding the various elements. And the various elements are governed by different regulations, rules, built on biblical text, built on rabbinic interpretation. We're going to talk about how all of those things work together. But as well, each area of Jewish law also has its own governing principles. That so sometimes certain ideas that may be relevant to matrimonial law don't necessarily apply to civil law or when dealing with issues of contracts and ownership issues. And so it's also important to understand the unique elements to various areas of halakha in order to understand those areas. In addition to understanding the broad concepts that we're going to talk about, such as rabbinic laws, biblical laws, enactments, customs, decision-making, and so on. So throughout this course, that's what we're going to be doing. So to start, the question is what? What exactly are we going to study within this course? So what we're going to study are about these various elements. So we're going to look at biblical law next week, and we're going to talk more about that then, about, well, there's 10 commandments, there's 613 commandments, there's positive laws, there's negative laws. We're going to talk about that next week. We're going to talk about exactly what we mean when we say biblical law. We're going to look at interpretations of biblical text, often referred to as exegesis. And we'll talk about the elements relating to that important area of law and how that process works. That makes up the bulk work of Talmudic discussion are these interpretations. We're going to look at rabbinic laws, enactments, and we'll talk about the difference between rabbinic laws and rabbinic interpretations and so on, and how rabbinic enactments and so on, how they function differently than a biblical law or from an interpretation. We're going to look at the issue of customs. Custom is a word that includes many different types of customs. We're going to break down those different types of customs and how each of them work and what binding effect different kinds of customs have, how different kinds of customs change. And so talk about, you know, oh, one synagogue prays Sephardic, one synagogue prays Ashkenaz. So that's, is that custom? Is that law? How is it, what do I do? It's my custom to wear this kind of clothing. Does that make a difference? Do I have to always then wear this kind of... What exactly do we mean when we talk about custom? That's a really important topic which we'll look at. And we're going to talk about many different issues. We're going to be... That's going to be our first term. If you picked up the schedule over here, the course is broken down into three different terms with a break of a month or so, month and a half, between each term. I tried to schedule the breaks at times when I thought people would likely be away for other reasons, end of December, Pesach, and so on. So hopefully the weeks that we do meet, you'll be able to attend as often as possible. So the first trimester, shall we say, or session, is going to be looking at these fundamental aspects that I just spoke about and how exactly each of them work and what exactly they are and how eventually how they work together. Right? How do these various elements come together? One area of law may be built of all of those various elements, which means that when trying to address a particular area of halakha, one needs to take into account all of these different factors and the different functions of all these different factors when rendering a legal decision about a particular area. If it sounds complicated, it is. Right? So that's what we're going to be that's what we're going to talk about. We're then going to look at ritual law, sometimes referred as chukim. We'll talk about that a little bit tonight. And there you find all the various, shall we say, more what we think of as religious type laws are found in that category. And then the last term, we're going to be looking at civil laws and looking at Jewish civil law. Along with that, we're going to talk about what happens when Jewish law is at odds with American law, with secular law. We'll take a chance to look at that as well. And hopefully through that you'll have seen the various elements that come together in creating the Jewish legal system. We're not going to be going through every single topic in halakha. That's not really the objective of this course. The objective of this course isn't to be a practical guide to halakha of, oh, I really want to learn the laws of Shabbat. I'm going to go take this course. That's not what this course is really going to do. It's really going to be breaking down the elements, the conceptual framework of these various areas of Jewish law that then, only if you go to a class about the laws of Shabbat, it'll make sense where those various laws are coming from. So to that end, I'm going to be doing a monthly class, sort of a practical halakha crash course style on Jewish law monthly on Monday nights. So everyone is invited to attend that. I'm actually going to be doing my first one this coming Monday night. We're going to be looking at Gentile-Jewish interaction, particularly as far as cooking is concerned, eating food cooked by someone not Jewish, and also looking at issues of Gentile assistance on Shabbat, pushing elevator buttons, etc., turning on lights, Shabbat goy, as it's sometimes referred to, just the practical 1, 2, 3, work through all of the issues. So if anyone's interested kind of in those practical halachic topics, come to that. 7:30 to 8 on Monday night will be a optional kind of text study if you want to see some of the sources. But then from 8 to 9 will actually just be the lecture where I'm not going to be really going through sources. I'm just going to be going through exactly how the laws work and the parameters of them. Okay. So that's a little bit about the class. Any questions about the schedule, topics? Yes?
Would you be recording the Monday class?
I will be recording the Monday class. I'm not going to be posting it online. If anyone is interested in getting one of those recordings, just speak to me privately and we'll try to make arrangement. But ideally, up to the class. That's probably the best way. I don't want those recordings getting out too much. No, it's just when you teach halakha, you're teaching in part to the people that are with you. And that's something we're going to learn about kind of in this course, is that halakha in certain is not black and white, and how you make legal decisions is because there's a variety of opinions, is a more complex issue. So it's not the kind of thing where anytime somebody, we spoke about that in the summer, when you write a legal book and it gets out there, so possibility is that someone who never met you and hasn't discussed the topic with you may not fully understand what it was that you were saying. That's why we saw in the summer there was a lot of pushback to the writing of Jewish legal books throughout the centuries, particularly for that issue. So certainly in the digital age, on one hand, it's a great opportunity to share ideas, but it also allows for ideas to be taken out of context. So, you know, especially when it comes to law, it's always good to learn those kinds of topics directly from somebody so that you can ask the questions, you can clarify, and so on. Okay. Let's look at some sources. We'll just start by quickly looking, just because we're part of the breakdown of the course. It's source number one. This is taken from the Talmud, tractate of Yoma, which deals generally with the laws of Kippur, of Yom Kippur. So it says as following. It says, our rabbis taught, my ordinances, my mishpatim, you shall do. Such commandments, which if they were not written in scripture, they should by right have been written, and they are following the laws concerning idolatry, immorality, and bloodshed, robbery, and blasphemy. So there's some kind of laws, mishpatim, that are things that we would intuit. Right? Most societies have laws governing murder, stealing, and so on. And then, but it also says, not just mishpatai ta'asu, but also that you shall follow my chukim. So what does it mean? And my statutes you shall keep, i.e. such commandments to which Satan objects, meaning laws which don't at face value have any rational reason that would obligate one to do that, right? One wouldn't just wake up and say, hey, you know what, we should do Passover and eat matzah if one didn't have, right? Meaning that one maybe makes sense to us, right? That's one at least we can give a reason for, but then you even have mitzvot like don't mix wool and linen together, right? No one would ever come up with that law unless it was told to us in the Torah. So you have those different areas of law. And so sort of within the course, we're going to break down those two different areas with the way that the course is structured of one term and the other term. To some extent, it really is part of one whole system. So they're not really entirely different, though I think the way we relate to them is a little different. And particularly because we don't live in a society where we govern ourselves, we spoke about this summer, to some extent certain civil laws have become less relevant. And so because of that, we tend to, and that's not true when it comes to ritual law, right? If there's a law passed in California, you can't do circumcision, a Jew is still obligated to circumcise. Well, we're going to see that's not necessarily the case with all civil matters, exactly how Jewish law governs in the face of differing positions within, you know, the court system in which a Jew finds himself living. And so for that reason, I've sort of separated them within the class, because in certain ways they're separate, though at the end of the day they are part of one system. Okay. What I want to do now is to talk a little bit, this is going to be our philosophy part of the course, talk a little bit about the meaning behind mitzvot. Why exactly we have them. So, that was a big question throughout the ages. The Jews grappled with was, why do we keep these mitzvot? Now, like we said, certain ones seem to make sense. Others don't seem to, at first glance, make sense. So what is a person supposed to make of these laws? We believe they're commanded by God. So what's up? Why does God have us jump up and down three times? Meaning, why does he have us do things? He doesn't command that, but why does he command things that, at first glance, don't have any rationale behind them. So let's look at what the Rambam writes, Maimonides, in his Guide to the Perplexed, in source number 2. And so he says, there is a group of human beings who consider it a grievous thing that causes should be given for any law. They think it's terrible to give a reason for a law. They say, don't give reasons for laws. Why? What would please them most is that the intellect would not find a meaning for the commandments and prohibitions. What compels them to feel this is a sickness that they find in their souls. Meaning, he thinks they're sick. Okay? For they think, it's very strong language, for they think that if those laws were useful in this existence and had been given to us for this or that reason, it would be as if they were derived from the reflection or understanding of some intelligent being. Meaning, if all the laws made sense, then one would say, they make sense. So, if, however, there is a thing for which the intellect could not find any meaning at all, and that does not lead to something useful, it is undoubtedly derives from God. If something doesn't make sense, well then, you would never reach the conclusion that, oh, it must be, maybe a man decided to make this law, and so you're forced to say it must be from God. But if all of the mitzvot make sense, then you would say, oh, maybe it's not from God. So they would prefer to wish that you couldn't find reasons for any of the laws, because then it would be clear if the mitzvot didn't make any sense, then it must be that they're from God. For the reflection of man would not lead to such a thing. It is if, and this is what he says, this is his critique, it is as if, according to these people of weak intellects, man were more perfect than his master, than his maker. For man speaks and acts in a manner that leads to some intended end, whereas the deity does not act thus, but commands us to do things that are not useful to us, and forbids us to do things that are not harmful to us. And so he says, what they're basically saying is that it's more likely things come from God if they don't make sense. But what they're really then saying is that God commands us to do things that don't make sense. And he says, that's ridiculous. Right? I mean, what are you saying about God then? If you're saying that. So then the question becomes, well, if everything makes sense, then, you know, and so the Rambam goes through and has then this basic idea that things can not go against rational reason, but we on our own wouldn't have necessarily said to do them if it wasn't for God telling us to do them, right? Certain mitzvot, that's the mishpatim. Even if we never had the Torah, we would still put together a group of laws about killing, stealing, and so on. There's other laws that, according to Rambam, don't lack for reason, but they wouldn't necessarily have been considered necessary to do if it wasn't God telling us, hey, this is something that you should be doing. But to say that they should be irrational, to prove that they're from God, he says, makes those people look silly and makes God look silly, and so they're wrong. In fact, he points out to the following verse, which is taken from Sefer Devarim, the book of Deuteronomy, source number 3, that says, keep them therefore and do them, for this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the nations, who shall hear all these statutes and say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. And so he says the Torah itself says that the nations will ultimately say, look how wise these people are. If we're doing things that don't make any sense, why would they say, look how wise we are? It must be that the mitzvot do make sense, and that's why ultimately the nations of the world will recognize it as such. Okay. And so he then goes forward and says, so what exactly then is the reasoning behind these mitzvot? Some of them don't, at first glance, have any justification, don't have any objective, what he calls an end purpose for them. And so he says as follows. This is also in Guide to Perplexed. There's 3 sections in that work. This is in the 3rd section. He says, the law as a whole aims at 2 things. Source number 4. What are the objectives of the Torah? Well, there's 2 objectives. The welfare of the soul and the welfare of the body. As for the welfare of the soul, it consists in the multitudes acquiring correct opinions corresponding to their respective capacity. Meaning, soul means the way you see the world. your characteristics, who you are as a person. As for the welfare of the body, it comes about by the improvement of their ways of living one with another. Meaning, body doesn't just mean exercise, it means the fact that someone isn't murdering you, the fact that you aren't stealing, right? You're not physically harming one another. For it has already been demonstrated that man has two perfections. A first perfection, which is a perfection of the body, and an ultimate perfection, which is a perfection of the soul. Right? According to the Rambam, the ultimate is the mind, the way one sees the world and oneself. But part of that process is the perfection of the body. Right? One needs to have a peaceful society, a society that functions right, where people treat each other with respect and dignity, in order that one can then have the freedom to cultivate the real objective, which is one's intellect, right? One's understanding of the world, right? That's a unique Rambam, not just to Rambam, but that's a particular stream of thought that we looked at last year. There's other streams as well, but that's the Rambam's position. He says, the true law, then, has come to bring us both perfections, meaning the Torah comes to help us do both. I mean the welfare of the states of people and their relations with one another through the abolition of reciprocal wrongdoing and through the acquisition of a noble and excellent character. And so the Rambam says that when looking at mitzvot and when attempting to understand their end, meaning their objective, their reason for being commanded, one needs to have a broad view, an inclusive set of tools. When trying to decipher that, one has to look at the practical issues of the obvious types of things of stealing, murdering, and so on. But one then also has to take into account other kinds of ideas and how various, perhaps, rituals teach us ideas about God. So when one keeps Shabbat, right, which is a testament to the fact that God is the creator of the universe. So keeping Shabbat reminds a person, oh, there's a God, he created the world. When one celebrates Pesach, it reminds a person that God didn't simply create the world and then take a walk, but God continues to be involved in the world. And so the mitzvot end up having other objectives that include teaching us ideas. Mitzvot, for example, he's famous for when it comes to sacrifices, and sacrifices were instructed in order to wean us off of idol worship. That it used to be that people brought sacrifices to gods, and so we're already kind of in that mode of serving in that way. So God says, fine, still do that, but just bring it to me instead. And so each of the mitzvot do have an objective, do have a goal in mind. What those goals are, one has to think about, one has to contemplate. The Rambam says maybe certain ones are hard to understand, but ultimately one can do that. And certainly that has been the position of many Jews throughout the years. Famous Samson Fall Hirsch in Germany, he wrote an entire work devoted to trying to identify the meaning and reasons behind the laws. One of the big differences between, let's say, Hirsch and Rambam was their treatment of details of mitzvot. The Rambam felt comfortable saying that sometimes the details don't fit into the broader framework of the reason behind the mitzvah in general. So while sacrifices, maybe the purpose is to bring a person, you know, to worship God as opposed to worshiping idols, but why you have to bring seven lambs as opposed to six or as opposed to eight, the Rambam says that doesn't really have any real significance. A number had to be chosen. And so a number was chosen. The details more help inculcate within us a sense of living a life of discipline. And that becomes the objective of the details. The mitzvah in general has an ideal. The details allow it to be disciplined, allow the mitzvah to have a clarity about how it should be observed, so that it is observed. If there were no details, and it would just devolve into just an idea, and this idea that practical, actually doing a mitzvah, as opposed to just thinking about an idea that stands at the core of a mitzvah, is much more lasting, or is much more impactful than just an idea. Which then kind of comes this interesting, as opposed to Hirsch, said no, the details do have inherent meaning, and if one understands the details, you can actually see how the details of the law actually are a part of the general objective of that area of law, which obviously is a much more complex way of thinking about things, but that was his perspective. What's interesting within kind of the idea, the concept of the Rambam, and he presents that there are ideas behind the mitzvot, and there was fear. We spoke about this last year. There was fear that his approach of giving reasons for the mitzvot in this way would bring one to say, well, you know, I believe in the idea, so I don't need to do the act. That was kind of a controversy surrounding it. Presumably, and the reasoning behind the Rambam, and we're going to look at a more contemporary kind of related issue to this topic in a moment, is an idea that I find personally meaningful when thinking about mitzvot, is that the Rambam would say, absolutely, the idea is the critical component in a mitzvah, but without the mitzvah, the idea will get lost. And I often think of the analogy of a glass of water. If you go to your friend and say, oh, can I please have some water? And they bring you a hose and just, you know, squirt it out. So it's going to be very difficult for you to drink that water, right? What you're really asking for is a cup of water, right? So that you can actually get to that water. And certainly when passing it from one person to the next, so if someone poured water into your hand, maybe you'd get a little bit of it. But if you then tried to put it into the next person's hand, there'd probably be even less. But if you have a cup, you can go from person to person, and everything stays in place. And to some extent, while maybe ultimately it's the idea of the mitzvah which is most important, without the mitzvah itself, without the cup, the concrete thing, it becomes very difficult for us personally to hold on to those ideas. The ideas will kind of fall out, but certainly from generation to the next generation, if you just try to teach ideas on their own, it becomes harder to transmit. But if we transmit actions, the actions are easier to transmit. Obviously, there's the fear. One may do the action without incorporating the idea at the core of that action. But if at least the action is preserved, hopefully, as that's done or down the road, someone doing that action will then reflect and say, oh, what's the meaning behind this action? And in that way, the idea will be preserved and passed on as well. Yeah?
It's okay to ask questions.
Yeah.
By according to his opinion, the mitzvot are given to us either to function in society or for education or self-control or any reason that or idea. So the bottom line is that we don't keep the mitzvot in order to keep the mitzvot, period. It's to our benefit. How do you look at it as Avodat Hashem or doing it just because God commanded us, but not to our benefit? If it's for our benefit, it doesn't it lose some depth or meaning? Or I'm just wondering what you think about it.
Listen, I think it's possible. I think that's kind of like what the Rambam's trying to get at, is he says, you know, he says, just the opposite. He says the fact that they have reasons is what makes them meaningful. I mean, that is, we're so thankful to Hashem for giving us this system of law, which is inherently meaningful and does things and so on. So certain mitzvot are more focused on God, prayer, and sacrifices and so on, and but you're right, certain things have this other element which is more I don't want to say you know, narcissistic, but you know, that has the element for society. And I guess it's when doing that mitzvah to have that appreciation. That's why sometimes we'll say a blessing before we do it, is to appreciate that, hey, this comes from God. But appreciating that God did it for our benefit is, you know, the Rambam would say that that's okay, right? And to some extent, Rambam says that's the function of the details. I mean, the detail serves that function of showing our commitment to be obedient to God, right? They don't necessarily have meaning of itself. You do the mitzvah, you say, you know what? God told me to do this. I want to serve God, and so I'm going to do the details as well. And so he would say that's how that element fits into it. But you are right that some didn't find this approach meaningful. And so you definitely find another approach, which is takes more that road, and that's something I want to look at now. The next verse we're going to look at is written by the great-grandfather of Rabbi Soloveitchik from Yeshiva University. This is like the father figure of the Soloveitchik family, really the beginning of the dynasty. His children, Chaim Soloveitchik, and then he had multiple children, and then eventually down to the Rav, and then this other... There's many Soloveitchiks that are running around the world today. All of them tend to be geniuses. So one of them spoke here this past Shabbat. They're a fun crew. So he and all sides of the spectrum. There's very Haredi Soloveitchiks, and then there's very non-Orthodox Soloveitchiks. They've kind of the family has branched out over the past two centuries. So in any case, so. This first Soloveitchik, Rav Yitzhak Zev Soloveitchik, wrote a commentary on Chumash called the Beit HaLevi. They're Levite Soloveitchik, so the house of the Levites is the name of the book. So on his commentary to the Pasuk that says, V'yigadet ha-levincha v'yom ha-hu, you should tell your son on this day, what's that a reference to? To Pesach, right? Telling him about Pesach. He says the following. What is that? What child is being spoken to? Right, we know about the four sons. Who is this child that we're talking to? So he says the following. He says, it seems more likely to me that this verse is referring to an educated older child who already knows about the Exodus. You're not telling about the Exodus. He already knows about it. However, his heart is turning towards heresy. That's it. We're not just talking about, the little tzaddik child. We're talking about the kid who's already says... is already perhaps turning away and saying that the commandments have reasons that are no longer relevant, and so they are no longer obligatory, as the Reform say. Right? This is at the beginning of the Reform movement. So he's saying that the child you're talking to is a Reform Jew. Right? They're educated. I don't know how many Reformed Jews today are so educated, but certainly the early Reform movement, they're very educated. They had the same education as their brothers and their cousins did. But right, they had different attitudes about it. And so he says, that's who the child is being spoken to, right? The kid who says, what's that to do with me anymore? These laws are so antiquated. They're outdated. The reasons for them no longer apply. Okay, I'm not doing idol worship anymore. Okay, fine, good. I don't have to do those 15 mitzvot now. Good, let's move on. Let's get rid of, And that was kind of the perspective that was being presented here. And so he says, however, it goes through a whole thing. I'm not going to read through everything, but I'll just read some more in the English. He says, however, regarding reasons, the truth is that is not the reason that compels the mitzvah, but the mitzvah that compels the reason. For every mitzvah in its deeper essence, its reason is not known to us. So what exactly does he mean? So let me explain what exactly he means over here. So he says the following. He says, if one were to think about, I told this at the Parashat class this week, he says, if one were to think about eating matzah on Passover, so I would ask, why do we eat matzah on Passover? Anybody know? Why is it commanded? What?
Remember the Exodus from Egypt.
The dough didn't rise.
The dough didn't rise. It was flat, or it's poor man's bread. We remember the slavery. It reminds us of the Exodus. So he says, that's not why we eat matzah. We don't eat matzah because of the Exodus. He says, we have the Exodus because of the mitzvah of matzah. He says, because there was the mitzvah of matzah, that's why God had the Exodus happen hastily, so that there would then be the kind of open reasoning for why we should eat the matzah. But the true reason for the matzah has nothing to do with the Exodus. It has some deeper mystical significance that stands at its core. And God just brought about historical events in such a way that would create the impetus or the justification for having us do the particular mitzvah. So it's an extreme kind of formulation, the way he kind of turns it all on his head, on its head over here. So you have to think about it sort of in the context of his battle with Reform. I don't know how compelling that argument would be to someone who didn't believe in it, but that was the perspective. But certainly this is an idea or conceptual idea, even if not formulated in such a extreme way, which finds its expression in many different places in Jewish sources, that says there's deeper reasoning for the mitzvot that we don't really understand. There is the whole cosmos, the way the world functions with angels and sefirot and Kabbalistic ideas and so on. When one does a mitzvah, we don't know the ramifications of how that mitzvah works, and different mitzvot affect the world in different kinds of ways. And yes, we do a mitzvah, it's good to think about how does this mitzvah affect me, what is its goal. But there's multiple objectives of every mitzvah. We only know the most surface ones. There's much deeper reasoning behind the mitzvot as well.
It's very great because there are many mitzvot who says you do this in order to remember Yitzhak Mitzrayim. Do this in order to remember...
The Mitzvah says Zecher Yitzhak Mitzrayim sometimes.
Very interesting, yeah.
You know, so but certainly within Kabbalistic literature, it's commonplace, and in many places, it's kind of this idea that we do the mitzvot, we don't really know what the reason is, but God knows best, and that's why we do it. And to some extent, maybe one shouldn't even think too much about the mitzvot. In fact, there's a debate in the Talmud about whether one should attribute reasons to mitzvot, and it specifically says, generally speaking, the Torah doesn't give reasons out of concern about what would transpire if we were to do so. Let's look at the next source number 5, which we skipped before. It says, Rabbi Isaac said, this is from Tractate of Sanhedrin, said, why were the reasons for the Torah not revealed? Source number 5, page 3. Why were reasons, the Torah doesn't say reasons, generally speaking, for the mitzvot. Because in 2 verses, reasons were revealed, and the greatest man in the world stumbled on those reasons. It states, he shall not take for himself many wives. Right? Polygamy is permitted in the Torah, but it says, one, especially regarding king, he should not take too many wives, lest they turn his heart away. Solomon said, I shall take many, and I shall not be turned away. Yet scripture writes, and at the time of Solomon's old age, his wife turned his heart. And so, and quotes about horses as well. In any case, the point is that, oh, you know, reasons aren't good, because then people say, oh, if you give me the reason, then it applies to him, it doesn't apply to me. Oh, that's for that kind of person. That's in that, but not for me. So in general, there's this attitude that it's not good to maybe attribute reasons, because when you attribute reasons, it allows people then to rationalize away the performance of the mitzvot. That's probably why there's probably a general trend within the Jewish community to not rationalize mitzvot, because so much of the Jewish community has turned away from mitzvot. But that's really just like one perspective. There's another perspective that says, no, it's good to give reasons, because that strengthens, that makes a person appreciate the mitzvah, while not denying that maybe there's other reasons for it, but having a reason that we can connect to is good. We actually then don't just do a mitzvah and serve God, which is a good thing, but we also learn something from that. And that's good when we learn something from it too. And so kind of different angles on the reasoning behind the mitzvot, the reasoning behind the halachot. Yeah.
Well, it also sort of begs the question, this is, the Torah is from God, and you were sort of referring to that. If there are certain ones where they give a reason, then, you know, no matter what you say, all of these make sense to me. But the ones where there's a reason that they gave a reason. So, you can have it both ways, really.
Say, why give a reason, then, in each of those places?
There are reasons in the Torah. We're going to take it literally as God's word.
Yes. So why are those reasons there?
If those reasons are there, there's a purpose for them. You know, we parse every single word.
Right. Yeah.
The reason given, then you're going to have to take that one seriously.
Yes.
And we sort of have to accept that. For the other ones, there weren't reasons given, maybe for this reason,
yeah.
Maybe not. And you can really have it both ways. It can be valuable to have a reason.
Oh, not to.
Right. Which is probably at the core of this debate about do we or don't we, how should we relate to reasons and so on. I'll leave that to everyone personally to kind of think about. But you're right, meaning people at different times in history have related to mitzvot in different ways. Meaning, there are people today who probably keep the Torah, who probably don't believe it's from God, but do it because this was a famous idea in the early reform movement and conservative movement of historical Judaism and so on, different ideas about the sense that we have historic community. Try convincing a kid to keep Shabbat because, oh, that's what your great-great-grandfather did as the sole reason. It's probably not going to be so successful for most kids. That's not necessarily the reason to say one way or the other. That's just kind of like a practical issue with it. But for individuals, at least, right? I think individuals have found different reasons for doing mitzvot, whether or not they believe the Torah to be literally God's word or not. But certainly the sense that it should be compelling or at least obligatory finds very little ground unless one does believe that in some sense these laws derive from God, whether it's through the wisdom that man received from God, directly written by God word for word. If one doesn't believe that in some sense it comes from God, then so take it or leave it. You know, if it's meaningful to you, you do it. If it's not meaningful to you, you don't do it. So that's not so much, we're not going to, you know, I'll leave that, you know, I'm glad to discuss that with people, you know, individually. We spoke about that a little bit more in depth last year. This year we're kind of just be, you know, taking it for granted and jumping into it. Yeah.
What was the context of the Rambam saying there's a group of human beings who consider a grievous thing what should be given?
He's probably talking about, I'm guessing, mystics, or you know, those who kind of take that that kind of approach. That's my guess. The Rambam was not such a mystic. Okay. Where are we at? Okay. Moving right along. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Good. Okay. Somebody said a nice idea to me yesterday, so I'll share it. He said to me, sometimes he's at work and people will be asking him about, why do you do this thing on Shabbat? Why do you do that thing on Shabbat? So he said to me, he said the truth is I can't explain to you every single detail of what I do, but trust me, everything together works. Which I thought was like kind of an interesting idea that, you know, there's so many laws, I'll tell you, associated with Shabbat. We can sit here and debate the nuance of every detail. Should this apply? Should that apply? But generally speaking, if a person does all the laws of Shabbat, it really is a day of rest. It really does make a separation between the week and Shabbat. It does accomplish a goal that way. And so even if one can't explain how each aspect fits into that purpose, as a general rule, it does kind of work. And I think that's you know, probably kind of the. That was an interesting way to explain it. It doesn't answer the question, but what it probably is true is that, given the reasoning for every detail, it's a worthwhile goal, and it's hard to do it. But when you take Jewish law as a collective, it has served us well. And while one can debate, and one should debate, you know, the applicability of various laws and details, as a general attitude, right, it has. Preserved us, right? As the saying goes, I think Zechad Ha'am says, as more than the Jewish people keep Shabbat, Shabbat keeps the Jewish people. And certainly that is proven to be the truth. Yeah, sure.
As we mentioned, part of the mitzvot are social. Let's say, don't steal, don't murder. Is there any discussion why God bothers giving us this mitzvot? We would have
yeah.
Without yeah. Giving it.
So yeah. Anyway. So yeah. So actually, this is actually interesting. Rav Cook talks about this. Rav Abraham Isaac Cook, who was considered to be chief rabbi in pre-state Israel, he talks about this view that Jewish law is built upon natural law. That it's not Jewish law was not meant to take the place of natural law. It's meant to build itself upon it. And so, to some extent, you know, person shouldn't just be, you know, be a nice person because, oh, that's what the Torah says. Right? A person should hopefully inherently have a sense that being a nice person is a good thing. And then, in addition to that, the framework through which one does that will then be governed by the Torah. So, just based on itself, how exactly the parameters of incest, murder, stealing, so those things aren't necessarily governed just by natural law. The sense that there's something wrong with each of those things that hopefully a person naturally relates to, but then the exact parameters for how that's to be observed, that's where the Torah, you know, comes along and helps govern us. And so, you know, if you see someone who's about to murder 10 people, and you have a chance to kill that person, so you might say, well, it's wrong to murder. I'm not going to do it. Or a person might say, oh, they're about to kill 10 people. Right? So that's where halakha...
That law that is obvious. Don't steal.
But what are the parameters of that? What about when it's intellectual property? Does it apply in that case? Meaning, halakha brings then the applicability of this idea further. And so Rav Kook said is that it's good to connect to the idea. That's what it's built on. The Torah was then taking it another step. Was saying, okay, great, we all have this idea that it's wrong to steal.
Those details. It's not controlling.
Sorry?
I'm sorry. The social law, the law of the land, also has the details. Intellectual property.
You're saying now. You're saying in America. You're saying there's details and whatnot. So there is this belief that the details of the Torah are kind of, right, from a Jewish perspective, we consider them to be the ideal. You know, to be the best way of doing it, but that it's not they're not supposed to be in conflict. It's supposed to be Torah as a enhancement, as it were, when it comes to those areas. That's the way he sort of looked at it.
Some people say that it's to give you reward, meaning if you don't steal or you do something that does make sense, give tzedakah, for example. Because it's in the halacha from God, you're doing it because it's from God. And you get the reward, and it's meaning. It's much more meaningful because by doing it, it's avodat Hashem. You please God or you worship God. So it adds a lot of them.
Along those lines is also the idea that, you know, if I'm doing it because I feel it's the right thing, so that's good when I connect with it. But what about in a situation where it's, you know what, if I steal that dollar, I can make $10 million and then give charity back. Right. So is it okay for me to steal that dollar? So we would say, no, it's not. You're not allowed to steal. So that's kind of then where halakha comes in, is that it's then this binding force upon us, right? So it kind of serves that element. Okay. We're going to be looking at different areas of law during the class, and we're going to be looking at sometimes the development, you know, the biblical, the rabbinic, the customs, the enactments, the decisions. To fully grasp some of the discussions, you need to have a grasp of the development of halakha, the historical development of halakha, which is not what we're doing in this class. We did that in the summer. We did a four-part series on the history of halakha, where we spoke about the development from the times of Tanakh, through the times of the Talmud, through the Middle Ages, to contemporary times, the different codexes, the different people involved, the different sfarim, the various Jewish books that were written, responsa, codes, etc. We're going to be referring to those codes, to those people, to those different stages throughout the course. It's important that you be familiar with them. I'll, you know, do little reminders as we go along, but I would encourage everyone to listen to those classes. All those classes have been uploaded to the internet. You can listen to them on the website. It's in the store sheet and on the front page under D, yutorah.org. If you go there and search my name, you'll find that series, History of Halakha. There's four classes, and I would strongly recommend that you listen to those classes if you weren't here over the summer. It will enhance your understanding of the class, but I wanted to really focus on the halakha itself during this year, so I did that kind of as a prequel to the course. So I recommend that you take a look at that. There I talk about different places, different centers of Jewish learning, spoke about the development of, you know, when the Sephardic Ashkenazic divergence took place and so on. So it's worthwhile to take a look at that. Just quickly, the course, now to wrap up with some practical considerations. Course structure and objectives. You saw in the back the schedule. It's possible that certain aspects of it could change during the year depending on how our learning goes. Maybe a particular topic will get changed or whatnot. These are the dates. These are the subject. It should stay the same. If things change, I'll obviously let you know. But that this is the plan. Sources quoted. We're going to be doing a lot of source quoting during this year of study. In order to understand these areas, we need to look at the various sources from all the different stages of Jewish development. Generally speaking, if the source was originally written in Hebrew or Aramaic, I will quote the Hebrew-Aramaic source, in addition, bring the English translation. If the original source was not written in Hebrew or Aramaic, if it was originally written in English, I'm just going to bring the English. If it was originally written in Arabic, I'm not going to bring the Arabic. I'm just going to bring the English. So that's why tonight, some of our philosophers that we quoted, they originally wrote their works in Arabic. There was no reason to bring the Hebrew translation of the Arabic and the English translation of the Arabic. We'll just bring the English. So, but when we do anything from Tanakh or from the Talmud and so on, I'll bring the source. We'll generally read the sources in English, but that way you have it there if you'd like to look at the original text. If anybody misses classes, again, for those that sign up and pay, I'm going to have CDs which I can give to you and the sheets from the week that you miss. Throughout the class, we're going to be talking about the components of halakha, the categories, and the legal process that goes along with it. And together, hopefully, we'll reach those objectives. I wanted to share with you my research resources so that can be available to you if you'd like to do some more independent study. So I'm just going to bring a couple works that I think are helpful. One, this is a great work. This is Jewish Law by Menachem Alon, who was an Israeli Supreme Court justice who wrote this is an English translation, but it's four-volume English translation, going through halakha, from a Supreme Court justice kind of rigor. It's excellent. It's also very expensive. I know it's also very complex. I don't necessarily recommend it for casual reading, but if this is a topic that is so interesting to you and you really want to do some serious study, this would be the set of volumes, but it's a few hundred dollars. So just bear that in mind. Another interesting work is written by Joel Roth. I believe he teaches at JTS, if I remember correctly. I'm not necessarily commenting on everything in the book, but generally speaking, he writes about the parameters of the legal process, and again, with anything you read, it's always good to compare it to other things. But he does quote a lot of the sources and issues and things involved, so this is going to be probably... Anything related to this is going to be a little bit complex, but this is probably a little bit easier, I would think, or maybe a little bit more user-friendly for you. And the other, a couple other Hebrew sources that I'm using, I'm not going to quote those, but another good English resource for doing these things is the Encyclopedia Judaica. So if anyone has access to that, that's a really good place to look as well for any of our subjects. And those will probably be the main kind of resources that I'll be using in addition to other Talmudic sources and whatnot, which I'll be quoting as we use them. In conclusion, I want to draw your attention to the last source in your source sheet. This is from Rav Sadia Gaon, who's considered to be the father of Jewish philosophy, the first to write kind of a comprehensive book on Jewish philosophy from Baghdad at the end of the first millennia. And he writes, the Jewish nation is a nation only by virtue of its laws. And here he's pointing out, he says, you know, Jews may not live in the same country, Jews may not speak the same language, but it is the laws that bind us into a nation. And for those of you who have traveled throughout the world and walked into some synagogue in some far-flung place and got in an invitation home for Shabbat lunch, or so on, right, can certainly attest to that you may not be able to speak to them so much, But you can pray with them, you can eat with them, and you can communicate. Hopefully you speak Hebrew, so you guys can so everyone can communicate. That seems to be the new Jewish language, which is nice. And it's true, it's our laws that bind us together as a nation. So I think having a better understanding of the thing that binds us together is certainly worthwhile. So hopefully throughout the year, we will have the pleasure of doing that together. So thanks so much. If anyone did not fill out one of these registration forms, whether or not you're planning to pay, even if you're just planning to attend, I ask that everyone fill out both sides of these forms. Thanks so much, and have a good night.